Welcome to the Old Frontline podcast question and answer section. In this bonus episode, we'll answer your questions that come out of the episodes of the podcast each week. Do make sure you subscribe to the podcast on your favourite platform, and please give us a like there or even a review. So, here we go with a new feature of the Old Frontline podcast. As I mentioned in the previous episode, you can now submit questions about current episodes or past episodes through two different sources. One through the Old Frontline Discord server and the other by email. And you can find the links to those in the show notes of each episode. So, I'm pleased to say that following the announcement that you can now pose questions and we'll answer them in these bonus episodes that we'll put out on a regular basis, I'm pleased to say that we've got six questions that have come in from people who listen to the podcast. And I'm hoping that these questions will prompt some more of you to ask other questions, either based on current material or perhaps some of your favourite episodes. So let's begin. Question one from Stella. What did the professional soldiers think of the civilian soldiers? And this came out of the episode that looked at from training to trenches, where we followed a kind of typical story of a British soldier from enlistment and training to them being dispatched to the front line. And we looked at how the army evolved from the outbreak of war with a volunteer but professional army, different to the other armies within Europe, which were all conscript armies, when at a given age young men were conscripted and did a certain amount of military service, then went to territorials and reserves, and then were called up. And it meant that armies like France and Germany, who had relatively small standing armies, could call on these reservists and territorials on the outbreak of war to expand their forces. So very quickly, both France and Germany, for example, others like the Austro-Hungarian army would be another example, and Russia, of course, with these massive armies, they're all able to field huge numbers of men very quickly in the conflict because of conscription. And the British army was different to that. It was a professional army, a volunteer army. But at the head of that army was Lord Kitchener, Secretary of State for War. And he was one of those who didn't buy into the idea that it was going to be a war that was going to be over, as the much lauded phrase was, a war that would be over by Christmas. So he called for the formation of the New Army, as it was officially known, and Kitchener's army, as it quickly became known in the national press and the local press and right across Great Britain. So an army of civilians was recruited to enlarge the overall size of the British army in case this conflict did go on, and go on it did. And the New Army was used. Before them, the territorials, the part-time soldiers from before the war, the territorial force formed out of the volunteers in April 1908 and then greatly expanded in that, what we call the Edwardian period. So they were a kind of different kind of soldier. They were professional, but they were part-time, so they weren't in the army all the time. They did training sessions in local drill halls, annual camps, and the idea was they would be used to bolster up the regular army, and if they'd signed what from 1912 was available, the Imperial Service Obligation, which got them extra pay and a nice shiny silver badge they wore above their left tunic pocket. If they signed up for that, they could be sent overseas to Malta, Gibraltar, India to relieve regular units there and release them for wherever the war was. So there's kind of three stratas, really, of British units saw the movement of a professional army to a part-time army to a civilian army. And this is what lies at the heart of Stella's question. What did the professional soldiers think of the civilian soldiers? It's a very good question, because the professional army, what Henry Williamson called in his books the Red Little Dead Little Army, that had marched off to war in 1914 and been wiped out in the battles of Mons, a retreat from Mons, Le Cateau, the Aisne, the Marne, First Battle of Ypres in particular, when over 56,000 men of that regular army became casualties and the territorials began to arrive, about 270,000 men in the original expeditionary force that qualified for the 1914 star, for example. The whole composition of the army changes, and in those regular units they see more and more reservists joining. So these men who had previous regular service been recalled to the army, recalled to the colours, as the phrase was. But within a year, the composition of these regular battalions had changed completely. So if you jumped on 12 months from the autumn of 1914 into the autumn of 1915, in the period of the Battle of Loos, the vast majority of men serving on the front line by then would have been a mixture of territorials, and probably, if we added them all up, a higher number of these Kitchener's men, these new army men. So what did those professionals think of them? Well, we have a lot of memoirs of professional soldiers. I interviewed some of the veterans that I interviewed back in the 80s and 90s, and I don't recall them having any kind of disparaging remarks all those years later, because that was seven decades on from the conflict, and those men had seen, in some cases like George Butler, nearly 4 years of war. George Butler was the Manchester teenage Tommy who served with the Lancashire Fusiliers and then the Machine Gun Corps and went right through the conflict until he was badly wounded in April of 1918. But the interesting thing with George, although he never said, I don't think much of those territorials or those new army men, and by the time of the Battle of the Somme, when he was in the Machine Gun Corps, he would have been serving alongside quite a lot of wartime volunteers. What he did throughout his service, and I have this in the photographs of him, is he differentiated himself from those other men. He kept his uniform smart and clean. He kept the stiffener in his service dress cap. By that time, most wartime men had taken it out and they had these kind of floppy caps, often called trench caps. But George kept his stiffener in his cap, and that signalled him out as a regular soldier. When Brigadier General Adrian Carton de Weert dropped into a shell hole alongside him in the Battle of Arras in April 1917 and took one look at him, could see that there he was, a smart young sergeant, as he was by then, wearing the stiffener in his service cap. He knew that this sergeant was a regular soldier, and he remarked upon it. So I kind of think, even in that kind of dress, he was making a statement there that he was a cut above the new army men. And if you think of it, a regular soldier, George went into the army at 12. When the war broke out 4 years later, he was 16. He was army through and through. If you cut him in half, he's khaki from top to bottom. And those kind of men are very proud of their training, very proud of their ability, very proud of who they are. And they see a bunch of civilians who turn up, who've never marched anywhere in their life, don't know anything about discipline, can't shoot a rifle. There's instantly going to be some kind of disparagement between them because of that. And you see that. You see in the memoirs of Kitchener's men that when regulars turn up to help them with training, they kind of look down on them. And these new army men, these Kitchener's men, they notice this. And when you think about it, it's quite a remarkable thing to suddenly pluck a load of ordinary men from the streets of Britain's cities like Accrington and Barnsley and Sheffield and Leeds and so many other places besides, or from the rural communities of Sussex and Kent and Cornwall and so many other places, and then thrust them into uniform and expect them overnight to be some kind of soldier. I remember Alf Rozelle, who was a volunteer in the Royal Fusiliers, saying this, that really it took a long while for them to feel like soldiers, that they were still civilians in their mindset until the army had broken down that mindset a bit and made them feel like they were part of a bigger army. So I think that initially those professional soldiers would have seen themselves a cut above everybody else and would have looked down on civilian soldiers. But as the war went on and they saw their regular comrades dwindle away, they too would have seen the necessity for a civilian army, for an army composed of volunteers who joined up. And I think that phrase volunteer, that concept of what brought these civilians into the army, was something that I would guess that the regulars could have some kind of respect for, because no one had forced these men to join one of these battalions. They'd joined voluntarily. They'd laid down their most precious thing that they had themselves and stepped forward into the light and said that they would serve and, if necessary, die on the field of battle. And the old sweats, what became known as the old contemptibles that fought in France and Flanders in 1914, would have had a lot of respect for that. And I guess that kind of leads us into how both those groups, the professionals who were there in 1914, the new army men who joined up in the early phase of the war, how would they then have gone on to view conscripts? And perhaps that's a discussion for another day. But I think identity in any army is a really interesting subject. And we spoke to Richard Van Emden in a previous podcast quite recently about his new book that looks at soldiers in Britain in those first 2 years of the First World War and their experience of that. And that's certainly something that I would point you to get a kind of an inkling into this. But you can also read Martin Middlebrook's First Day of the Somme, where there's a little bit of that kind of theme going through it. So that was our first question. A great one from Stella, and I hope we've answered that. Question number two from John Hayes Fisher, a great friend of the podcast. John helps a lot, and he's always got plenty of questions when he listens to episodes, which he pings me via WhatsApp or whatever. But it's good to answer one officially, if you like, on the podcast itself. So thanks for this one, John. I'm sure you've said this before, but there are probably other newcomers who don't know it. But where does the title, The Old Front Line, come from? Is there a background to it? We all know what the front line is, but why the old front line? Well, that's a good question. The idea of the old front line didn't just come about with this podcast. I launched my first website in 1999, and I was inspired to do that by Tom Morgan, who did Hellfire Corner, the first, as far as I know, the first ever Great War website on the internet. Tom was a true pioneer in that respect. And once the internet was obviously beginning to take hold, I wanted to contribute something then. And I set up a website through a French server, got hold of some Microsoft technology and software to kind of build this website. And I thought, what am I going to call it? And for me, the obvious title was The Old Front Line, because one of the very earliest books that I'd read in those early visits to the battlefields following having gone to the Ypres Salient in my school was John Masefield's The Old Front Line, which is his account of visiting the Somme battlefields in 1917 and looking back to that Somme battle and talking about what the landscape was. And that book had a great, great influence on me. And I had an edition from the 1970s that I got out of the library that I took with me on an early Somme trip that had some then and now photographs of pioneers digging a road through Avaluy Wood and then how it was today. And I walked through that wood with my dad and took a then and now photograph when I was there. And I kind of followed bits of Masefield's book around on those early trips. And he talks a lot about landscape, and he talks about what the landscape looked like. And I think probably in those early days, I hadn't quantified it, but it really kind of laid that seed of an interest in landscape that continues to this day. So The Old Front Line, Masefield's book, had always been special to me. And when it came to launching that very first website in 1999, which sadly is no longer here, it kind of disappeared about a year or so ago. Those kind of websites are a bit redundant now. But that was a title I chose for that website. So 4 years ago, when I was looking at doing this podcast, I thought, what can I call it? And there was only one title that I could really use, and that was The Old Front Line. And I'm so glad that I did, because I think for me, the whole phrase, The Old Front Line, encompasses pretty much everything that we're trying to do with this podcast, to examine the battlefields of the First World War from more than a century on, understand those battlefields, interpret those battlefields, and look at the layers of those battlefields that writers like Masefield had already in 1917 begun to kind of lay before us. And I think that's really important, because it's not just about the battles, and it's not just about the men and the units and the to-ing and fro-ing of the trenches. It's much more than that. There are so many elements to the story of this old front line. And I think that through the podcast, I'm not just explaining those to you, I'm actually thinking about them myself. And a phrase that I've begun to use with one or two friends in discussing this is this idea of the culture of the old front line. Now, I don't know yet what that exactly means. I can see some pointers to it. And there is a culture of the old front line, what it tells us, what it means, what lessons it has to give in terms of the history of the war, but I think perhaps wider lessons. What is it about it that draws us back each time? And I think all of that are elements of its culture, of what it stands for. And that, I'm sure, will be very much an ongoing discussion for this podcast in many, many episodes to come. So the title comes from Masefield's book, a classic book, still in print, well worth seeking out. And a year or so ago, when Richard Williamson died, he was one of Henry Williamson's sons, and he had the bulk of Henry's library. Some of it had been given to the University of Exeter, but a lot was left over, which they didn't want. And when he sadly passed away, he was a really smashing guy, Richard Williamson, who I had the pleasure to take to the Great War battlefields on several occasions and stand where his father had stood. And for me, Richard was one of those who was perhaps most closely like his father, the way he looked and the way he spoke. He had so many tales to tell how Christmas was always difficult for them as children, because his father became morose when he thought back to the Christmas truce and all that it stood for, and why hadn't the war ended, and he went into a black, dark depression, which for those young children like Richard should have been their happiest day of the year. But I had the pleasure of standing there and understanding more about Williamson's war. And sadly, when Richard passed away, as I say, a big chunk of Henry Williamson's library came up for sale. And one of those books that I saw on a book dealer's list, the famous Tom Donovan, was an edition of The Old Front Line with some notes in it by Henry Williamson, his signature and his little owl motif. And I thought to myself, if I'm going to buy one of these books from Williamson's library, it's got to be that one. And I know I mentioned that in a previous podcast about Henry Williamson's books, and you can go back through the podcast catalogue to find that. So I hope that kind of answers it, really. That phrase and that title of The Old Front Line has been with me since my very first trampings along that old front line, and it will always stay with me, and it's become the brand, if you like, for this podcast. But it's not something I own, really. As I say, it has a culture of its own, and we're all a part of it. That's kind of what I find so fascinating and so compelling about it in so many ways. And over the years of visiting that old front line, I've discovered not just places, but many fellow travellers, companions on that journey, who I've met perhaps just once to talk about one location, and others I've met many times and they've become friends. And I'm sure that too is all part of that culture. And I like to think that we're all kind of travelling that old front line together when we discuss it here on this podcast. So question number three, and this comes from John, who posted this on the Discord server. Now you might be saying to yourself, what is a Discord server? Well, Discord is a kind of software. It's a bit like a chat group. It's used for a lot of online gaming and discussion about gaming. We're not going to be doing any of that kind of thing with it, but it's a really useful way of interacting with people and being able to open up a little channel to everyone. And like I say, there's a link to that on there. You can just go onto the Discord server, post your question on there, and then it will be featured in a future one of these Q&As. So this is from John, and John asks, I've always wondered if some of the missing had gone AWOL, absent without leave, and emerged after the war. Is there any instances of this? Well, I have a couple of stories. One of those comes from Will Bird. Will Bird is a Canadian who served with the Black Watch of Canada from 1916 through to the end of the war and was awarded the Military Medal for his bravery at Mons in November 1918. And he wrote several books on his war experiences. One, his general memoir, which is And We Go On, which later became Ghosts Have Warm Hands. And he then wrote another one where he travelled back to the old front line. He didn't use that phrase, but back to the battlefields after the war, and recounted his experiences for a Canadian newspaper that was then put into a book called 13 Years After. And I remember reading that in the reading room of the Imperial War Museum many years ago. I forget whether it was Rose Coombs or one of the other members of staff there who got this book out and said, You should have a look at this. You should read this. And I sat there and started reading through it. And there was a great story in there where Will Bird went into a cafe in Albert, and a guy came and sat with him and they got talking. And this man was a British veteran of the Great War who had served but had disappeared, was posted missing. He saw an opportunity in a battle to walk away from that battle, disappear off the face of the earth and somehow get away. Now, many men tried to desert under those circumstances and were picked up and court-martialed. Some were executed for that, as we discussed in the Shot at Dawn episodes. But this chap had got away, and he knew that going back to Britain would be impossible. He'd be discovered, he'd be arrested, who knows what would happen to him. So he stayed in France and he built a new life. When the war ended, he could kind of come out of the shadows and he could build a new life and become a new person. So he was living in Albert under an assumed name and living a new life, presumably with a French wife and perhaps children. And I remember when I read that and then reread it many years later when I was living at Courcelette, and Will Bird had been in the battlefields of the Somme, up at Arras and many places that I knew so well. But I remember reading that again and wondering who that guy was, and was he buried in Albert Communal Cemetery under this French name, but actually he was a British veteran of the Great War whose name, whatever that real name was perhaps on a memorial somewhere in Britain and on one of the great memorials to the missing somewhere on the Western Front. So it does seem that some men kind of fell through the gaps, and when you think of the size of the army, it's not an impossibility. It's kind of the stuff of fiction. But here's another example for you. And this one came from my old pal John Nichols, who wrote Cheerful Sacrifice, the fantastic, the best book about the Battle of Arras, in which he interviewed lots of veterans. And I think it was a colleague of John's who started research into his grandfather, who had been killed in the fighting of the Great War on the Western Front. And he found the older members of his family not that keen to discuss him. And right at the end of the life of one of those, the family secret came out. So there was this soldier, he died on the front. This chap had travelled with John to the battlefields, I believe, and seen his name on a memorial to the missing, which, don't quote me, I'm pretty sure was the Arras Memorial. And he kind of accepted that. And then when this elderly relative was in the last days of their life, they told him the story that what had actually happened. 2 decades after the death of this man on the battlefield, a woman had turned up at the family home holding a child that looked remarkably like the soldier who had died. to tell them that he had just died and this was his child. And the family, so shocked, kind of slammed the door in her face and could not accept this, and the woman disappeared into the night, never to be heard of again. And so the presumption with that, and if you think of the kind of battlefields and the chaos and the carnage of the First World War, that this man had somehow swapped his dog tags with the body of a mutilated soldier that couldn't easily be identified, and those remains had been found with his dog tag on, and then the signal had gone back to the War Office, and the telegram had gone to the family, and the medals and the memorial plaque and the memorial scroll and everything else had been sent in memory of that soldier who had been fallen, and his name not just added to a memorial to the missing, but again to a war memorial in Britain. There he was, one of the glorious dead, but actually he'd survived, and in his case, by some miracle, had got back to Britain, perhaps after the war, perhaps he too had been at large in France, and then when the war was over, he somehow crept back to Britain and lived a new life under a new name, but obviously told his wife that he married in his new life, I should say, what the truth was and who his real family was, and that's how she was able to go and knock on that door. Now, I can't guarantee the veracity of that story, but I think when we look at those two examples, that one from Will Bird and the second one from many years later, we can see how this kind of thing is possible. Missing soldiers who perhaps weren't that missing in, like we say, the chaos and the carnage of the battlefields of the Great War. If somebody wanted to disappear, if that was their objective, then perhaps what better place? And I'm almost kind of surprised that there hasn't been a novel based on that kind of storyline. Perhaps there has, and some of you will write in and tell me. So I hope, John, that answers that one for you. Question number 4, which was sent in by Steve McQuaid via email. And again, in the show notes, there is an email link you can click on. Opens up your email provider, and you can send an email question in. And Steve says, you reference many times how the British and Commonwealth troops travel from here to there along the front line, taking up new positions, becoming familiar with the terrain, the enemy, then moving elsewhere. I think you also mentioned the Germans adopting a different approach, with units holding their bit of the line for long periods. At many levels, that approach sounds the best and most efficient. Is there a general view on what worked best, and how was morale, for instance, impacted on both sides by the difference? Communications and supplies, tactical knowledge of terrain. It seems so fundamental to all that happened. That is, if I heard things correctly, and the approach was different. So, Steve, you didn't hear things differently. It's what you say is exactly right. If you look at the British experience of the Western Front in the Great War, probably going back to the question from Stella about the difference between professional and civilian armies, the British Army was small when it went to war in 1914, just 7 divisions of 20,000 men each, plus cavalry and everything else, but a small army, just over 270,000 men in the original British Expeditionary Force, holding by the end of 1914 about 20 miles of the 450 miles of the Western Front. And as the army expanded and the front held by the army, and then Empire, Commonwealth troops from all over the Empire, from Australia and Canada and New Zealand and Newfoundland and so many other places besides, I mean, the list is almost endless. We could spend the rest of the podcast listing all the different nations that contributed towards parts of the BEF, but you know what I mean. If we look at how that army expanded, it saw a longer part of the line being held and more units. And the British approach was to move those units around, because forever you're attacking the enemy, you're fighting battles in different places, whether it's Loos or Flanders or the Somme or Arras or Cambrai, and you need to move those divisions to the areas where you want to have your offensives. So you're not holding the line for long periods of static warfare, you're taking the fight to the enemy, so you're moving your troops around. And it means, although some units did stay in some sectors for a long time, 49th West Riding Division, Yorkshire Territorials, held the canal bank north of Ypres for almost a year from 1915 into 1916 before they moved down to take part in the Battle of the Somme, for example. Mostly, British troops moved around a lot. They went to Arras, and they went to Ypres, and they went down to the Somme and moved around. And when you look at the diaries of men and accounts and war diaries of units, you see this. If you compare that to the Germans, then it's very different. The sector south of Messines, where just over 10 years ago we were privileged to work alongside Simon Verdigham when he dug that part of the battlefield up with a massive archaeological project, and we filmed it for a Channel 5 documentary. That part of the line around Messines was held by the Bavarian Army Corps for a big chunk of the war, from the end of 1914, when amongst the units that were there was Hitler's own Bavarian Reserve Infantry Regiment, through to the other units that served within that Bavarian Army Corps that were drawn from Bavarian units, and some of those were there for a big chunk of time from the static warfare period through to the Battle of Messines in June of 1917. And if we jump down to the Somme, 26th Württemberg Division, which I've spoken about quite a lot on this podcast, that held the line at different points from Serre, then mainly from the Redan Ridge down to Beaumont-Hamel, down to the Ancre Valley and across to Chapval. At one point it had held Auvilliers and La Boisselle, had been in that area as well. That division took over the line in the autumn of 1914 and remained defending those kind of sectors right through to the end of the Battle of the Somme in 1916. Now, that's not untypical of many German units on different parts of the front. Keep them there for a long time, they build up the infrastructure, they know the battlefield inside out. But their policy, of course, is different. They're on a defensive footing. They're fighting a defensive war for most of that period, fighting back an enemy who is attacking them or taking them on in trench raids and patrols, you know, outside of big battles. So it's a different kind of approach. But which one is best? I don't know. I can't give you an answer to that. If you're attacking an enemy to defeat them, you need to move men around. If you're defending ground for a long period of time, you want troops that know that ground inside out so you can slaughter the enemy when he tries to attack you. But the danger of that tactic of keeping one unit in a forward position or a part of the battlefield for a long period of time, particularly when the enemy is interested in that battlefield, is that it will be reduced systematically by casualties. It will be ground down by the attritional nature of First World War fighting. And if we look at trench warfare in the Great War, we see a lot of examples of this. The 119th Reserve Infantry Regiment, the ones that defended the Hawthorn Ridge area on the 1st of July, very few men who were there when the mine was blown on the 1st of July and then defended that ground against units of the 29th Division were still serving in that sector when the Battle of the Somme ended in November 1916. It had suffered some staggering level of casualties that was upwards of 80% by that time, killed, wounded and missing. So it had been, as I say, ground down by static trench warfare and defending the same sector for a very long period of time. And when I read accounts of the current war involving trench warfare in the Ukraine, you see kind of elements of that. And if you saw the recent BBC documentary about one area of woodland in Ukraine, I think it was something like 99 Ukrainian soldiers defended that position, and by the end of the battle, I think only about 20 of them were still standing. The others had been killed, wounded, or had gone sick as a consequence of that service, which is not untypical for trench warfare in the Great War. So you're kind of seeing parallels there with the past and the present, and all of it giving us an insight into the realities of trench warfare. So which one was best, Steve? I don't know, but both of them, one way or another, were costly. Perhaps just holding the line one place for a long, long period of time, perhaps in the long run, that was more costly for that individual unit, and the whole composition of that unit would have changed greatly. But it's a fascinating element, and I don't think any historian has really come to a conclusion as to which approach was best, because the approaches are driven by two different factors. On the Allied side, the desire to fight the enemy, defeat the enemy, and on the German side, to defend ground and defeat their enemy, which are the Allies attacking them. So that moves us on to question number 5 from Claire Crilly on Twitter. Now, this is another way of asking questions, but I would say on Twitter, or X as it's known now, things can easily kind of get lost. And I know that I don't always see replies to tweets or whatever they're called now. So use the Discord server, use email. That's the best way. But thanks to Claire for this one, which is a kind of a practical one for those who visit the old front line. So Claire says, it would be good if you gave listeners good, reasonable accommodation recommendations on the Western Front. The usual place I've stayed at Ypres over the years has now got way more expensive than I can afford. Could this be for Belgium and France? So I'm not going to mention as such specific places. If you kind of look at the types of accommodation that's on the battlefields now to base yourself to go out onto the old front line to explore these places, there's so many, many choices. If you want to stay in the centre of Ypres, there are some top-class hotels that obviously charge top-class prices. Novotel and the Ariane, you're looking at a couple of hundred euros, perhaps, a night for a room there with breakfast. But then there are many other accommodation options within Ypres itself. Cheaper hotels with smaller rooms, perhaps a star less and so on. And then there are bed and breakfast places, of which there's quite a few. There are also apartments, Airbnbs and otherwise, that you can kind of let. And then out on the battlefield area itself, a lot of the villages now have B&Bs and quite a few farms. I was up near Track X Cemetery recently. I noticed that the farm, I think it's Canadian Farm actually, has now become a B&B as well as a working farm, I think. So that's an option. And then you can rent houses. Nick at Hoot Crater's got a big house. I think it can hold about 16, 18 people. So obviously that's quite a big bit of accommodation with like 9 rooms. So it costs quite a lot per week, but there are smaller houses you can rent. And then if you come out of Flanders down into northern France, you've got a similar kind of thing. So there's bed and breakfasts all over the place. There are smaller hotels. There are chain hotels in France. They tend to be out of town, so you've got to be aware of that. The Ibis in Albert is located out of Albert on the fringes of it, on not quite an industrial park, but not dissimilar. It's got its own restaurant, but there's a McDonald's close by, and that's about it, unless you fancy a fairly long hike into Albert itself. So bear that in mind. But in some of the bigger cities like Amiens and Arras, there are bigger hotels with more stars, but obviously that comes with a kind of a premium. And again, Airbnbs and flats you can let. And Gîtes de France, which is kind of a national chain of holiday homes that you can rent out. There are quite a few of those scattered right across the First World War battlefields. You can go on the Gîtes de France website, look up a place and kind of see what is available. And they are, in my experience, quite good value for money. I use those quite a lot for different aspects of the different work that I use outside of touring. So that's a kind of option as well. But I quite like small hotels, kind of quirky hotels, particularly ones in towns, or not even ones in town. So when I was staying in Ypres recently, I stayed for the very first time at the Kasselhof at Hoog. So on the Menin Road, right in the middle of the battlefields. I mean, you couldn't get more on the old front line there, where I open my curtains and there's mine craters, German mine craters from 1916, that were blown underneath Canadian soldiers and, you know, kind of surrounded by the old front line there. So that's another kind of option as well. So there is a lot of choice out there. And there are English-run bed and breakfasts. I've never stayed there myself, but I know a lot of people listening to this have stayed at number 56, which is at Overlers on the Somme, which overlooks Mash Valley. And there are others besides. So you've got quite a lot of choice. I mean, you can go on to various websites, local tourist websites, and you can find all kinds of options for these. It really depends on what kind of accommodation that you're looking for. But for me, one of the things I like when I'm staying somewhere, Ypres slightly different because Ypres is kind of very much at the epicentre of the Great War in Flanders, and you're in that history if you stay in the city itself. And I like staying in the city and going up onto the ramparts of a summer's evening, or going down to the Meningate very late when the Meningate is empty of people and it's a bit more silent. I mean, you can't do that at the moment with the renovations, but last year and the year before, once COVID had kind of passed us by, we could travel again. It was great for me to be back in the city and being able to go down to almost have the Meningate to myself, not quite to myself, but there I was with the names of 55,000 soldiers who never returned, whose bodies were never found, or their last resting place is not known. So you're never quite alone there. But that's kind of one benefit of staying in a place like Ypres. And I think Ypres is unique in that. That kind of gives it a different kind of reason to stay there, because you are so connected to the Great War in that one city. But in other places, when I stay on the battlefields, that's why I like using jeeps, because I try and pick places that are actually in little villages on the battlefields, or we can walk out in the evening and stand on a bit of ground. We stayed in one in Carnoy, on the southern end of the Somme front, near to the Talu Boise, close to the front lines where the POWs went over on the 1st of July. And we could walk in the evening and look up and see the front line where Billy Neville kicked his footballs, for example, the 8th East Surreys and things like that. So there's a lot of choice out there. And I can't tell you where to stay or which place is better than another. It depends on your reason for going there. But there's a lot of choice, and make use of that choice and try different things, because you may well get a different kind of experience in your walk, your visits, your contact with the old front line by staying somewhere that's slightly out of the norm to what you've stayed in before. And then our sixth and final question is from Stuart Price, also via email, and a really good question to kind of end on. The question I have, says Stuart, is what safeguards, measures, did you take when interviewing veterans to ensure what they were telling you was accurate? Obviously, you were interviewing them many decades after the Great War ended, and memories get distorted, fade or confused, which could have impacted on their ability to accurately recall exactly what they experienced. I'm grateful for your thoughts on this matter. Well, that is a good question, and I've partly addressed that to a degree in an episode that I did on Great War veterans and what it was like to interview them. It's something that I've also discussed with Richard Van Emden. Obviously, when I spoke to these men in the 1980s and early 90s, it was 7+ decades from the Great War. And over that time, then how they viewed things would have potentially changed. You know, if we look at our own lives and we go back just 2 or 3 decades, we can see our memory of that kind of time might be very, very different. But what I found with the vast majority of them, and there were some who told me what I would now describe as estaminet stories. So they came out with stories that were not true, that were kind of stories that when soldiers sat down with a beer or whatever it was in one of these estaminets behind the lines, they'd say, "Hey, Bill, have you heard about this?" And they'd tell this story. And I'll give you an example of this. There was a guy that I interviewed who was a warrant officer, a battery sergeant major in a Royal Field Artillery unit, and was awarded the Meritorious Service Medal. So this was a man who had had quite a long war, quite a difficult war in some cases. He was an army field brigade, so they moved around a lot, and he'd been decorated with the MSM, and so his war wasn't for nothing. He'd done quite a lot. So he was an experienced soldier, and he told me a lot of really interesting stuff, particularly about gun sights and the guns at Ypres in 1917. But one of the stories he told me was about a soldier that he said had been executed. Now, I often asked veterans about this. If I knew what division they were in and I had an idea that in that division or even their unit a man had been executed, I would ask them. But before that information was released in books like Shot at Dawn, it was a kind of a general question. So I asked him and he said, yes, he said, in fact, I was detailed for a firing squad. So I said, really? And he said, yes, he said, yeah, it was a major in the Army Service Corps. Already hated the war, or he was totally against the war. And of course, the higher ups, they couldn't allow that. You couldn't have a major who'd be standing there saying the war would have to end and we shouldn't be fighting. So they had to make an example of him. So they decided to shoot him for what he'd said. and I was on the firing squad. And my ears kind of pricked up at this, and I thought, a major in the Army Service Corps executed? I don't think so. But I kind of listened in, didn't correct him, let him tell the story. So he's telling it, and I said, okay, so you were on the firing squad, what happened? And he said, well, he said, I didn't actually pull the trigger in the end, he said, because luckily for me, the night before I was gassed, so I didn't have to do it. So that never happened. There was no major in the Army Service Corps executed, and certainly not one who kind of stood up and protested against the war. That wouldn't have resulted in a capital offence and an execution. So that was a barrack room estaminet story, and his get-out clause was being gassed, in inverted commas, the night before, so he didn't have to take part in the firing squad. So you had to be kind of mindful of those things. And I had one or two little stories like that. But out of those 300 or so, 350-odd that I interviewed, I would say that the vast majority were different, perhaps, in our approach to the memories of the past, in that they had kept their experiences bottled up, and they had rarely discussed them. And in some cases, I knew, had never really discussed them. And it was like an unstoppable force that had been building up inside them for years and years. And they got to an age, and I discovered this again with the Second World War generation, they got to an age in their 80s and 90s where they became, and I would describe it as, confessional, where they wanted to impart this story, these memories. They wanted to almost get them out of their system and tell them to somebody. And luckily or unluckily for some of them, I don't know which, in some cases, they met me. And I was able to ask the right questions, press the right buttons, use the right phrases to get these people to trust me enough for them to tell me these stories. And as I think I've mentioned in previous episodes or in discussing veterans, seeing a guy once was never enough. That I would go, some veterans, I only saw them once because it was clear that they had a story to tell, but it was kind of one-dimensional. Some of them did not have the words really to describe what had happened to them. And then there were others. I could tell there was a lot more to this man. There was a lot more that he wanted to say. And it was going to take quite a few visits to kind of get that out of him. But that unstoppable force that had been building up, once I'd kind of popped that cork and it all came flooding out, the level of detail was astonishing. And I would go away and look up details in unit histories and war diaries, what was then the Public Records Office, and be astonished to find what they told me was pretty much spot on. Sometimes they weren't aware of specific details. You've got to remember that these veterans are not official historians. They're veterans. They're telling you what they saw. And that is the other element to this, is that if you approach oral history from the point of view of wanting to discover what the ultimate secret of the First World War or anything was about, that isn't the right approach. And oral history is unreliable for the bare facts of history, the framework of history, because each man has his own interpretation of the events that he takes part in. But that's part of the story. That is the value of oral history, because it gives you interpretations. And if you want to discuss an event like the Battle of the Somme, you're going to have a textile worker from Manchester give you one level of understanding on it, and a steel worker from Sheffield give you another, and a farm boy from Sussex, and so on. Each of them will have a different view of it. And it's what I would call the myriad faces, the myriad stories of the Great War. And each one has some kind of value. I often see academic historians kind of not quite disqualify oral history, but knock it. And I sometimes think that those oral historians have probably had no experience of trying to uncover that kind of oral history, whether it's for a First or a Second World War generation, and perhaps don't understand what it will give you. And one thing that I will always be grateful for from having spoken to those veterans is to help me tune to what my old pal John Dray used to call the wavelength of the Great War, that through those veterans I learned a language of their war, how they describe food, how they describe ranks, how the army functioned, how people saw each other, what made them laugh, what motivated them, all those kind of things. And then a commonality in experience of trench warfare, of going into battle, of discussing fear. And the ones that I could get to really trust me did discuss fear, what it meant to go into battle and how that affected you. And sometimes they didn't have all of the words, all of the language to really tell the tale to its full extent. But then I kind of think that the simplicity of sometimes of their language was almost the genius of it. That these very simple phrases of a man sitting on an embankment with his comrades of the 17th Royal Welsh Fusiliers watching the rest of the Welsh division march into the mist of Death Valley and the hammerhead at Mamet's Wood and be wiped out, and how he could just discuss that in clear, concise, basic terms, almost like an automaton, and probably sitting there in 1916 and watching that, maybe he felt like one, devoid of emotion, impossible to take in the spectacle of line after line of men disappearing into the mist, and the firepower, the killing power, the industrial killing power of the Maxim machine gun. So I couldn't, at the time when they were talking to me, verify everything that they said. I just let them talk. That was the thing. And I never took anything that they said as gospel. And I would say I learned that lesson again with the generation of the Second World War. That's another discussion for another day and another podcast, perhaps another podcast series maybe. But if you go into the idea of oral history, as I say, telling you some greater truth about the war in terms of its history, that isn't the right approach. What these men will give you is an insight into the experience of war, what war does to men, how it affects them. And that was something that I learned very, very quickly, again in that kind of simplistic, almost self-effacing language that they used. One veteran I used to go and see often, I'd go and see him, say, "How you doing?" And he'd look at me and kind of look at the floor a bit and say, "I fought the Battle of the Somme in my bed again last night." And that, of course, was his way, his simple way of saying that the war had never left him and haunted him still. So I feel that they gave me probably much more than they realised, particularly the ones that I saw again and again, and the ones who dance through my head every time I go to those battlefields because of that. Of the hundreds that I interviewed, there was perhaps a dozen that stand out as the ones that remain what I often describe as my lodestars as I walk round those places. And without fail, they were pretty much all men who had kept the war to themselves for a very long time. But now their moment to tell that tale was there. And I like to think that somehow I helped them deal with those experiences. I didn't say anything. I didn't offer them counselling. Far from it. But I gave them an opportunity to discuss something that could not be discussed with anyone else. I was enough of a stranger, but enough of a friend for them to trust me. And I will always be grateful for that. And it is the one thing that I continue to miss. So thank you for these questions. This will be a regular feature. I'm not saying it will be every week. We'll build up some questions and then we'll answer them in this bonus episode. And I hope that each time the questions will bring us back to reflect more and more on different aspects of the old front line. You've been listening to an episode of The Old Front Line with me, military historian Paul Reed. You can follow me on Twitter at SomCorps. You can follow the podcast at Old Front Line Pod, Check out the website at oldfrontline.co.uk, where you'll find lots of podcast extras and photographs and links to books that are mentioned in the podcast. And if you feel like supporting us, you can go to our Patreon page, patreon.com/oldfrontline, or support us on Buy Me A Coffee at buymeacoffee.com/oldfrontline.